3. Clarifications and potential objections. Before demonstrating that conversational exercitatives afford a better model for Langdon's purposes, a few clarifications are warranted. First, as I have argued, conversational exercitatives change the bounds of conversational permissibility, and it is well worth noting that other things do this too. Suppose, for example, that while discussing Mike's dog, my neighbor's dog Sage runs into the room and starts chewing on Mike's leg. Since all conversational participants witness Sage's misbehavior, Sage is thereby rendered the most salient dog at that point in the conversation. Sage's behavior, or our recognition of it, changes the score and, as a result, it would be conversationally improper for any conversational participant to try to refer to any other dog with the expression "the dog," until, of course, the salience facts change again. That Sage's behavior, or our recognition of it, changes the bounds of conversational permissibility in no way undermines the claim made here that conversational contributions do so too. After all, what can be done through conversational means can also often be done non-conversationally. Thus, that other things change the bounds of conversational permissibility in no way undermines the claim made here that conversational contributions do so too. Second, one might be tempted to think that particular utterances have but one elocutionary force. If what I have argued here is correct, however, then many, perhaps even most, conversational contributions are conversational exercitatives and thus have exercitative force in addition to whatever other surface elocutionary force such utterances have. My Finbar utterance, for example, is both an assertion and an exercitative. Although this may seem counterintuitive, there is already considerable precedent for attributing several elocutionary forces to a single utterance. The canonical account of indirect speech acts, for instance, maintains that such utterances have multiple forces. Saying, for example, "Can you pass the salt during a meal?" is, on this account, both literally a question about the addressee's abilities and an indirect request that the addressee pass the salt. If, however, one is especially wary of multiple forces, there are a variety of ways to avoid a commitment to them. Third, it is also worth noticing that a single utterance can be both an Austinian exercitative and a conversational exercitative, and that this in no way undermines the important distinction between them. As I have argued, any conversational contribution, and thus any Austinian exercitative, invoking a rule of accommodation is also a conversational exercitative. Suppose, for example, that while discussing Mike's dog, my three-year-old son walks into the room and I notice, although Mike does not, that my son has blown a bubble clear out of his mouth and into the hair of Mike's frail elderly mother. Suppose that, in response, I set a new rule for my son by saying, "You are no longer permitted to chew bubble gum in public." This utterance is clearly an Austinian exercitative. Since it also renders gum chewing a relevant topic in the current conversation, it thereby changes the score and is thus also a conversational exercitive. Thus, that a single utterance can be both an Austinian and a conversational exercitative in no way undermines the important distinction between them. After all, my Finbar utterance is both an assertion and a conversational exercitive, but the distinction between assertions and exercitives is in no way undermined. Fourth, the considerations offered here in support of conversational exercitives may well afford reason to recognize other ways in which a speech is covertly exercitive. Consider again the uttering, "while dining," of "can you pass the salt" as an indirect request. Such an utterance may generate a reasonable expectation of cooperation and thus place a certain sort of obligation on the addressee. By changing the normative facts in this way, one might be tempted to say that such an utterance is an exercitive. Since the permissibility facts enacted are not conversational permissibility facts, the exercitative force under consideration is not that of a conversational exercitative. Since the utterance does not express the content of the permissibility fact enacted, it is not an Austinian exercitative either. Of course, much more philosophical work would need to be done in order to substantiate this potential phenomenon, and it is not my aim to do so here. I raise this possibility only in order to respond to a challenge that it may pose. If the uttering of "can you pass the salt" is covertly exercitive, then one may well suspect that all speech is covertly exercitive, and this may trivialize the very notion of exercitive force and thus undermine the phenomenon of conversational exercitives. Even if it can be shown that all speech is, in some way, exercitive, this need not trivialize exercitive force, since we can be discriminating about exercitives by being discriminating about the permissibility facts enacted. Clearly, some such permissibility facts count more than others. After all, similar strategies for avoiding triviality are implemented throughout philosophy. 38 Second, if it is true that all speech is, in some sense, covertly exercitive, then the philosophy of language ought to recognize that it is and offer an account of how it is. In addition, pursuing the possibility that all speech is covertly exercitive in this manner may well be a fruitful way to cash out the claim that all speech both exercises and enacts power relations. Finally, if the covert exercitive force in question is generated via the cooperative nature of the activity in question, as our example suggests, it may well be that rules of accommodation are generating that force. If that is the case, then this potential phenomenon may actually strengthen, rather than undermine, the importance of the phenomenon of conversational exercitives. Fifth and finally, one may object that the enacting of conversational permissibility facts is a mere causal, that is, perlocutionary, effect of conversational contributions. If conversational contributions merely cause the score to change, by invoking a rule of accommodation, then they merely cause the enacting of new conversational permissibility facts and are thus not exercitive speech acts at all. This concern is misplaced. When I say to my children, for example, you are no longer permitted to chew bubble gum in public, the new permissibility fact enacted springs into existence as I speak. It would be incorrect to say of such a case that my utterance merely caused the rule to be enacted. Similarly, because of the peculiar nature of rules of accommodation, when one makes a conversational contribution invoking a rule of accommodation, the score automatically changes. It is not merely caused to change, and that, in turn, automatically changes what is conversationally permissible. Of course, there is the general problem of maintaining the distinction between elocution and prelocution, especially in light of the fact that successful elocution depends on various causal processes, for example, speaking, hearing, and understanding. This general problem, however, does nothing to undermine conversational exercitives in particular. VI, on meeting the five challenges, as we have seen, conversational exercitives are speech acts that enact permissibility facts. They change the bounds of conversational permissibility and are therefore exercitive. We saw, in section IV, that the felicity conditions of Austinian exercitives undermine Langdon's claim that pornography is an exercitive speech act. In what follows, I demonstrate that the felicity conditions of conversational exercitives are different from those of their Austinian counterparts. They are covert exercitive speech acts that afford a much more promising paradigm for Langdon's purposes. 1. Locutionary content. As we saw in section IV, part 1, the fact that pornography does not appear to express the content of the permissibility facts it allegedly enacts undermines Langdon's analysis. Unlike Austinian exercitives, though, conversational exercitives enact permissibility facts without expressing the content of those facts. Thus, if pornography is akin to a conversational exercitive, the fact that it does not express the content of the relevant permissibility facts is no reason to suppose that it does not, in fact, enact them. In this regard then, conversational exercitives afford a better exercitive paradigm for Langdon's purposes. 2. Speaker intention. As we saw in section IV, part 2, Austinian exercitives are sensitive to both the speaker's elocutionary and locutionary intentions. Langdon's analysis was undermined by the fact that each of these important felicity conditions fails in the case of pornography, unlike their Austinian counterparts. However, conversational exercitives are not sensitive to either of these sorts of speaker intention. Consider first the speaker's elocutionary intention. Recall that when I changed the subject and started talking about my childhood dog Finbar, I changed salience facts, and thus the score, and thereby changed the bounds of conversational permissibility. That I did not intend to change the bounds of conversational permissibility is simply irrelevant and does not constitute a defect. Consider now the speaker's locutionary intentions. As a conversational exercitive, my Finbar utterance managed to enact a new permissibility fact by making Finbar the most salient dog at the time of utterance. That my locutionary intentions do not match, by default or otherwise, the content of this permissibility fact is simply irrelevant. The fact that the speaker's locutionary intention fails to match the content of the permissibility fact enacted is simply not a defect of conversational exercitives. Thus, if pornography is akin to a conversational exercitive, then the fact that both sorts of speaker intention fail, in the case of pornography, in no way undermines Langdon's claim that pornography is an exercitive speech act. As such, conversational exercitives afford a much more promising paradigm. 3. Hearer recognition. As we saw in section IV, part 3, Austinian exercitives are sensitive to four sorts of hearer recognition and, in the case of pornography, all three of these important felicity conditions fail. As a result, Langdon's claim that pornography is an exercitive speech act was undermined. Unlike their Austinian counterparts, However, conversational exercitives are not sensitive to any of these sorts of hearer recognition. Consider first the hearer's recognition of the speaker's elocutionary and locutionary intentions. Clearly, conversational exercitives cannot be sensitive to either sort of hearer recognition, since the analogous speaker intentions are absent in the case of conversational exercitives. No issue regarding the hearer's recognition of them can arise. For this reason, I will consider instead the hearer's recognition of the actual elocutionary and locutionary force of the utterance. Even if my interlocutor does not consciously recognize that I changed the bounds of conversational permissibility when I started talking about my childhood dog Finbar, I changed the bounds of conversational permissibility all the same. Her failure to recognize the exercitive force of my conversational contribution is not a defect of my utterance. Moreover, the exercitive force of my Finbar utterance is non-defective even though my interlocutor fails to recognize the precise content of the permissibility salience fact that my utterance enacts. Clearly, conversational exercitives are not sensitive to hearer recognition in any of the many ways that Austinian exercitives are. Thus, the fact that all four sorts of hearer recognition fail in the case of pornography in no way undermines the claim that pornography is akin to a conversational exercitive. 4. Authority. Recall that Austinian exercitives are authoritative speech acts. The speaker must have authority over the domain in which the expressed permissibility facts are enacted. If, as Langdon contends, pornography is an Austinian exercitive, then the speakers, that is, the producers, distributors, and consumers, of pornography must have the authority to enact permissibility facts in the heterosexual, sociosexual arena, as we saw in Section IV, Part 4. However, it is unclear that this condition is met. In fact, it is unclear even how one might go about establishing that it is met. If, as I have suggested, pornography is akin to a conversational exercitive, then this authority condition is either met or misplaced. On the one hand, there is a sense in which conversational exercitives, like their Austinian counterparts, are authoritative speech acts. In such a case, the authority condition must be and is met. Recall that the authority required of the speaker is limited to the domain over which the enacted permissibility facts preside. Since conversational exercitives enact permissibility facts in the very conversation to which they are contributing, conversational participants must have authority over the actual conversation in which such participants are contributing. It is clear that a competent contributor to a conversation is an authority over the conversation that he or she is creating. On the other hand, one might deny that conversational exercitives are authoritative speech acts exactly because no peculiar authority is required. In such a case, the authority condition is misplaced. It matters little, therefore, whether we say that conversational exercitives are authoritative, and that all conversational participants have the requisite authority, or that they are not, since no peculiar authority is required. Either way, the authority condition is either met or inapplicable and thus poses no challenge to the current hypothesis. 5. Pornography is unconscious conditioning. As we can see, conversational exercitives, unlike other speech acts, do not function at the level of communicated intentions. They are unintended, unrecognized and unexpressed. The rules of accommodation operative in the context of a conversation are sufficient to generate the non-defective exercitive force of such utterances. Conversational exercitives function in the covert manner in which pornography is alleged to unconsciously condition our responses. That pornography works on us without our awareness therefore does not prevent it from being a speech act, since conversational exercitives are speech acts that function in a similarly covert manner. In sum, conversational exercitives demonstrate that speech can enact permissibility facts without expressing the content of those facts, without the speaker intending to be enacting such facts and without the hearer recognizing that such facts are being enacted. As such, they help Langdon to meet the five challenges raised in Section IV, VI. Pornography is akin to a conversational exercitive. The proposal offered here is that pornography functions like a conversational exercitive. Since I am not suggesting that pornography actually is a conversational exercitive, there is no need to establish that pornography is involved in what can properly be called a conversation. In order for pornography to be akin to a conversational exercitive, however, rules of accommodation need to be operative in the domain over which pornography allegedly enacts permissibility facts. Since pornography is alleged to enact permissibility facts in the sociosexual arena, the proposal that pornography is akin to a conversational exercitive requires that there are rules of accommodation operative in that arena. There is ample reason to believe that such is the case. First, the sociosexual arena is, albeit loosely, rule-governed. In any particular sociosexual context, Some behavior is clearly out of bounds. Second, the rules operative in that arena are accommodating in the relevant sense since they adapt to the actual behavior of participants in that arena, and within certain bounds, of course, what passes as appropriate thereby is appropriate. If Hans and Heidi are each sexually aroused by yodeling, then yodeling is for them an appropriate form of foreplay, since sexual activity, like a conversation, is a cooperative activity, and since what is sexually appropriate is jointly negotiated by participants, there is good reason to suppose that rules of accommodation are operative in the sociosexual arena. In what follows, I illustrate how the revised proposal applies to pornography. In particular, I show how pornography, as akin to a conversational exercitative, may subordinate and silence women in the precise manner Langdon alleges. The examples offered will be quite vague. This is an unavoidable consequence of the fact that we do not yet have access to the precise nature of the rules of accommodation generating the exercitative force in the sociosexual arena. Suppose that pornography, via rules of accommodation operative in the sociosexual arena, renders certain speech acts unspeakable for women. If these speech acts are ones that women ought to be able to perform, then pornography silences women. Suppose, for example, that, via rules of accommodation, the speech at pornography enacts felicity conditions for sexual refusals such that some women, at least some of the time, cannot possibly refuse sex. Perhaps these felicity conditions make it the case that a woman's saying no to a sexual advance necessarily constitutes coy sexual acceptance, since a woman ought to be able to refuse sex. Rendering sexual refusals unspeakable for women constitutes silencing. Thus, if pornography enacts such felicity conditions, pornography silences women. Suppose that pornographic speech enacts, via rules of accommodation, permissibility facts such that it is permissible to force a woman to have sex under certain circumstances. Perhaps, it is permissible to rape a woman so long as she sexually excites you or so long as you have spent a certain amount of money on her. By rendering rape permissible, pornography would thereby subordinate women. Here is another possibility. Suppose that pornographic speech enacts, via rules of accommodation, permissibility facts such that it is normal and appropriate for a man to be sexually excited by the degradation of, and violence towards, women. By legitimating the sexual abuse of women, pornography would thereby subordinate women. Suppose finally that pornographic speech enacts, via rules of accommodation, permissibility facts such that it is permissible for men to operate on the assumption that the nature of woman is to serve man, sexually or otherwise, by constructing a false but authoritative conception of woman's subordinate nature and legitimating the mistreatment of women, pornography would thereby subordinate women. Thus, if pornography enacts permissibility facts that subordinate women, and, as we can see, there are a variety of ways in which this may be done, then pornography subordinates women in the precise manner that Langdon contends. Notice that if pornography, as akin to a conversational exercitative, silences and subordinates women via rules of accommodation, then pornography does so in a highly covert manner. It need not state the content of the permissibility facts it enacts. The speaker need not intend to silence and or subordinate, and the audience need not recognize that pornography does so. V.I. Remaining challenges. I have argued that maintaining that pornography is akin to a conversational exercitative, rather than an Austinian exercitive, enables Langdon to avoid five important challenges to her analysis. My suggestion, however, has its drawbacks. In what follows, I consider some of the challenges that remain. First, although the hypothesis that pornography functions like a conversational exercitative does better justice to MacKinnon's claims about the covert manner in which pornography functions, it does not obviously explain how pornography, allegedly, reconditions our desires. Of course, Langdon's original analysis fares no better. One might respond, however, that enacting permissibility facts affects our desires since our desires are, partially, constrained by what we believe to be permissible. This response is also open to Langdon. More work would, of course, need to be done to substantiate this possibility. 1. Mere fiction. The conversational contributions considered so far have all been cases of so-called serious speech. When I said, for example, we had a childhood dog named Finba who used to steal undergarments from neighborhood clotheslines and so we had to get rid of the dog, I was, by so doing, communicating the locutionary content of my utterance. What Kent Buck and Robert Harnish call the communicative presumption is operative in the context of this utterance. That presumption, however, is often suspended. Suppose, for example, that the speaker is telling a joke or a fictional story. In such cases, the conversational contributions constituting the joke or story are non-serious utterances, dialogue in plays, mimicking, jokes, fictional storytelling, sarcasm, irony, hyperbole, iosis, and teasing are all examples of non-serious speech. If, as many allege, pornography is mere fantasy or fiction, then pornography is non-serious speech. In order for pornography to be akin to a conversational exercitative, two things must be shown. First, it must be established that non-serious conversational contributions are conversational exercitives. Second, it must be shown that non-serious conversational contributions can enact conversational permissibility facts outside of the non-serious, fictional context of utterance. It is fairly easy to see that both conditions are met. Consider, for example, the following conversation. Donal: Hi Peter. What time is it, Peter? It's about 3. Donal: Thanks. Hey, my brother told me a great joke last night. Peter: Oh yeah, Donal? Yeah. This guy goes into a bar and sees a chicken pecking at the Guinness tap, and Peter, laughing: Where does your brother get all of these jokes? Donal: I think he spends his days surfing the web for them. Peter: Grimace, I'd hate to see a dirty old chicken pecking at a Guinness tap I might be drinking from. Donal: Chuckle: No doubt. Hideous prospect. No. When Donal says this guy goes into a bar and, the communicative presumption is lifted. Clearly, Donal's joke utterance is non-serious. Although Donal does not assert the content of this utterance, story or joke, his utterance nevertheless changes the score and is thus exercitive. Donal's joke utterance makes the topic of chickens pecking at Guinness taps relevant to the conversation. By changing the score in this way, Donal's joke utterance thereby changes what is conversationally permissible. Had Donal not said what he said, even though his utterance was non-serious, Peter's final utterance would be conversationally improper, only because Donal's joke utterance introduces the topic of chickens pecking on Guinness taps, is Peter's utterance conversationally appropriate. As we can see, non-serious conversational contributions change the score and are thus conversational exercitives. Notice also the important fact that Donal's joke utterance changes what is conversationally permissible even outside of the non-serious, fictional joke context. Peter's final utterance is serious, and yet it is conversationally appropriate only because of Donal's non-serious joke utterance. Thus, the alleged fact that pornography is mere fantasy or fiction is no reason to doubt that pornography is akin to a conversational exercitive. 2. Genuine permissibility facts must be violatable. It may seem, on close inspection, that the conversational permissibility facts enacted by conversational exercitives are impossible to actually violate. The cooperative nature of conversation coupled with the accommodating nature of conversational rules may seem to render outright violations impossible. If this were the case, two serious problems for my proposal would result. First, if an alleged permissibility fact cannot be violated, then there is no intelligible sense in which it is a permissibility fact. Thus, if the permissibility facts enacted by conversational exercitives are not genuine permissibility facts, then the conversational contributions that enact them are not exercitive speech acts. Second, if the permissibility facts enacted by conversational contributions are impossible to violate, then conversational exercitives cannot function as an adequate model for Langdon's purposes. For if pornography is to subordinate and silence, it must enact permissibility facts that effectively prohibit a fairly wide variety of actions. For an illustration of this concern, consider again my Finbra utterance. As a conversational exercitive, my Finbra utterance makes my dog the most salient dog in the conversation, and this allegedly affects what Mike is able to do with his words. That is, Mike cannot, for example, refer to his dog with the expression "the dog" until his dog is made most salient. The present challenge is that utterances that appear to violate this permissibility fact actually manage to change salience facts so that no violation actually occurs. Suppose, for example, that Mike immediately responds to my Finbra utterance with, "Oh, I meant to tell you that the dog slept with me last night." Since Mike could not plausibly be talking about Finbra, who died in 1972, he is taken to be talking about his own dog. Since Mike's utterance requires that his dog is the most salient dog, the score automatically adjusts to accommodate his utterance. Thus, the very rules of accommodation that allegedly generate exercitive force appear now to undermine it by making it seemingly impossible to violate the conversational permissibility fact allegedly enacted. As we can see, obvious violations of conversational permissibility facts trigger a principle of charity rule of accommodation which, in turn, changes the score so that no such violation actually occurs. If this were to happen all of the time, then conversational permissibility facts would be impossible to violate. Unfortunately for communicative purposes, but fortunately for my thesis, this does not always happen. The interesting cases, for my purposes anyway, are those in which the violation of a conversational permissibility fact goes unnoticed. Because such violations are not noticed, they do not trigger the principle of charity that undoes them. Suppose, for example, that immediately after my Finbra utterance, Mike says instead, "The dog was hard to handle." Suppose Mike was still thinking about his dog's visit to the vet and that he intended to be talking about to his own dog. Since Finbra is the most salient dog in the conversation at the time of Mike's utterance, and since Mike's utterance can plausibly be taken as a claim about Finbra, he is rightly taken to be talking about Finbra. First, this example shows that the permissibility facts enacted by conversational exercitives are such that they can be violated. Second, there is an important sense in which Mike's intended speech act fails exactly because it, non-obviously, violates the permissibility fact, covertly, enacted by my Finbra utterance. Finally, Mike is misunderstood as a result. Although obvious violations of conversational permissibility facts may trigger rules of accommodation that, in turn, adjust the score so that no actual violation occurs, non-obvious violations are possible. Since violations are possible, conversational contributions do enact genuine, that is, violatable, permissibility facts and are therefore exercitive. 3. Too easy to reverse. Finally, and most troubling, the permissibility facts enacted by conversational exercitives are, unlike those allegedly enacted by pornography, easily reversible. Moreover, each participant in the conversation seems just as able to change the permissibility facts of the conversation as any other participant. If Mike brings up his dog, for example, and I want my dog to be most salient, I can easily bring up my dog again and make it so. Thus, it seems that if pornography is really akin to a conversational exercitive, then we should be able to easily change the score back again. The fact that we cannot appears then to undermine the hypothesis offered here that pornography works like a conversational exercitive. There are several possible responses and I consider each in turn. Perhaps the speakers of pornography have a special sort of authority that enables them to enact permissibility conditions that are not easily reversible by others. Note that requiring that the speaker have special authority renders such speech more akin to an Austinian exercitive. As we saw in Section IV, Part 4, however, delineating what constitutes such authority and demonstrating that the relevant speakers of it, and are exercising it, are rather daunting challenges for this approach. It is useful, therefore, to consider approaches that do not require that the speaker have, and be exercising, such special authority. We have already seen an interesting example of speech that enacts difficult to reverse permissibility conditions even though the speaker does not have any special authority. Recall Seamus's utterance that Italy is not boot-shaped. By saying what he said, Seamus raised the standards of accuracy in the conversation and he did so without any peculiar authority. For reasons that have yet to be delineated, it is easier to raise such standards than it is to lower them. Consequently, it is difficult for Seamus's interlocutors to subsequently change the standards to what they were. Notice that, by raising the standards, Seamus's utterance limits what it is appropriate for his interlocutors to say. Thus, by saying what he said, Seamus managed, without any special authority, to enact difficult to reverse permissibility conditions. A similar phenomenon seems operative in the heterosexual sociosexual arena. Once some formerly taboo sexual practice is introduced and treated as permissible, it thereby is permissible in virtue of the rules of accommodation operative and, once this happens, it is difficult to subsequently reintroduce the taboo. An exploration of the mechanisms responsible for the difficulty of conversationally lowering such standards may therefore illuminate the manner in which pornographic speech manages to enact permissibility facts that are difficult to reverse even, though no peculiar authority is required. There is yet another possibility for how pornography, understood as non-authoritative speech, can enact difficult to reverse permissibility facts. Its covert and silencing nature may account for it. Perhaps the covert nature of its exercitive force prevents potential dissenters from recognizing its harm. Perhaps also the silencing constituted by it prevents such dissenters from managing to reverse the unjust permissibility conditions once they are recognized. If something like this is correct, then pornography's present social authority may actually be the effect, rather than a necessary condition of, its silencing. On this suggestion, the dissenters are effectively silenced so that there is no one left to question pornography's resulting authority. Consider the following example. Suppose that a certain conversation presupposes that moral theorist Q is a fictionalist. Suppose also that Q is unaware that such a presupposition is operative. There is a sense in which Q is thereby silenced. Try as he might, he will be unable to convince his interlocutors of his realism, since all of his sincere and robust realist utterances will be taken as the mere convenience talk of a fictionalist. In such cases, it can be quite difficult to identify the presuppositions operative, but suppose that Q nevertheless manages to do so. Although he may be able eventually to set the record straight, he will have considerable difficulty in so doing. Perhaps pornography works like this. It changes the permissibility conditions in the covert manner discussed in this article. Then the covertly enacted permissibility conditions silence women and, since this is not generally recognized, it makes it all the more difficult for the, thereby, silenced to then set the record straight. Acts. Conclusion. In this article I have presented a previously overlooked sort of speech act. The conversational exercitive changes the bounds of conversational permissibility in a highly covered manner. It does so without expressing the content of the permissibility fact being enacted, without the speaker intending to be enacting such a fact, and without the hearer recognizing that it is so. As such, the conversational exercitive affords a better speech act model for Langdon's purposes.